Welcome to the CRE Podcast, 100% Canadian, 100% commercial real estate. Now here are your hosts, Aaron Cameron and Adam Pawatic.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast, powered by First National. I am Adam Pawatic, sitting here with Aaron Cameron, live at the Real REIT Conference. Thanks, of course, to Granite REIT for sponsoring this video series. Our guest today is Brady Welch, co-founding partner of Slate Asset Management.
Or SLAM, or, we just found out.
If you're into brevity. We have had his brother on before, but this is the Brady's version of the story. Aaron's already threatened to fact check. Go back and listen to the old episode, make sure the stories line up, see who's telling the bigger fish story. But we're glad to welcome you to the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks, Adam.
So let's jump into it then, the background story of how you got into real estate.
Okay, so this is where you can check out.
Oh yeah, no, I'm going to. I'm going to hold you accountable to this.
Yeah, no way. Anyways, first of all, thank you for having me and participating in this. I am Canadian. Blair and I grew up just west of Toronto, a place called Burlington. Looked at the steel mill every day growing up in Hamilton. And I think that gives a lot of perspective. Our father was a real estate developer. So we kind of grew up in the real estate business, really not really understanding that. And we graduated in the early 90s, which was, I don't know whether we're heading to that cycle, but it kind of feels familiar of where we're going right now. It was a time when there wasn't a lot of liquidity in the market. There was a lot of correction in values. And our father gave us some advice and said, listen, boys, if you want to get into real estate, go work for smarter, larger people and see if you like it. And then maybe we can have a discussion down the road. And both of us had the good fortune of being able to work, I think, with the preeminent private equity in real estate at the time. And so, and not only being Canadian, but it gave us perspective where we were able to actually go abroad and learn. And so we started in the mid 90s working for a gentleman called John Graykin. At the time it was called Brazos, who now it's Lone Star. So I would say one of the biggest distressed buyers of real estate.
Your brother said the biggest, but anyway, keep going.
Yeah. I mean, probably one of the biggest. And I think back then it was called Vulture Funds, and we were buying non-performing loans and REO assets from financial institutions. And as young people, we had the huge, I think, benefit of just seeing a lot of transactions and seeing a lot of deals and not even knowing that. And then from there, my brother moved to New York, and then I worked a little bit with a company called Trustcan, which owned a lot of joint ventures in Canada with large office buildings across the country. So I got a little bit of institutional exposure with Canadian institutions. And then we actually worked together again at Fortress, started in 98. I was really brought on to be the real estate person. Blair moved to Tokyo to open up the Fortress office. I was there from 98 till 2005, really working in Canada, the US, and Europe. So I tell that story because A, we're Canadian, which I think when you work abroad, it actually helps saying you're Canadian. I think that helps a lot of people like Brookfield to say you are Canadian. We're well respected. A lot of smart real estate people that come from this country. And then secondly, you know, working abroad, right? It gave us a different perspective maybe than others. It's not a right or wrong thing, but it gave us perspective and really in the infancy of private equity. And being able to bring those skills and that knowledge back to Canada really.
Would you say that real estate transcends borders?
100%. Like the real estate.
Like it's just dirt.
Well, and it's the same fundamentals. Like where rents, what are the economic drivers and who are the players and how much does it cost to build? It's the same thing. However, it's micro when you need to know what's going on the ground. So you can't invest, I think, and not be present. So everything that Slate does, we make sure we have people on the ground. So I think
it's a weird dichotomy, right? It can be looked at 30,000 feet the same, but you got to have boots on the ground at the same time.
The two block difference could be night and day in terms of your investment.
Yeah. So I think like that's what we learned. Like you think like, listen, there's a lot of respect for the Brookfields, the Blackstones, like all these big, but they go to all sorts of markets, right? And it's funny how a lot of Canadians are like, how can you go somewhere else? But they do it all the time and they do it very intelligently. But when they do invest, they make sure they have local people on the ground to get feedback. So that's.
They seem to only invest in sort of the AAA investments, or is that a misconception of mine?
Well, I mean, I think, listen, they've had a lot of success, those big firms. I mean, Blair and I always talk about like, I want to do all the deals that we used to do 25, 30 years ago with them. And it's great that they've gotten so big, but that creates huge opportunities for platforms like Slate, right? Because when you go raise $20 billion funds, you cannot be doing small deals. It'll just, their business model doesn't work like that. But they didn't start raising $20 billion funds back 20 years ago. they raised like $500 million or they raised $1 billion. And those are big funds, but that creates opportunities for us. And that's what we do. That's the middle market that we play in.
So you're at Fortress. Sorry, I don't get
it. Is that your fund size? Is that the...
Yeah, so I'll talk. So like SLAM, which is Slate Asset Management, was really four pillars of our business, which is the first thing, which I think we're known for in Canada, which is direct real estate investment in equity. So we do those typically through funds, whether they're closed-end funds or open-ended funds. We invest across the spectrum of risk, whether it's opportunistic, it's value-add, or core plus. And we also have two REITs where we're significant investors of, and they came from private equity strategies, which we like the actual strategy of the business and we like the assets. And instead of selling them, we actually took them public, which created liquidity for our investors. And then we actually do development here too, in residential and industrial side. So that's our private equity side in direct investment. In the last 3 years, we've grown our business to really three new strategies, which the second one is real estate credit. So we bought a business which came with a platform and a book, and we bought that really at the beginning of the pandemic. So now we're in credit. So we've been underwriting real estate equity risk. It was logical for us to get into credit. And then the pandemic created the opportunity for us to get in and what we thought was an attractive basis with a team and with a performing book. That book's about a couple billion. It's all in the US. We've done a couple of deals in Canada. We'd like to roll that out into markets where we're already underwriting and own real estate. So it'd be Canada and Europe. And then the third thing is we've started an infrastructure, more of an impact infrastructure business, which I would call more, it's real estate adjacent. If we look at the world today, there's a lot of government policy that's going to push commercial real estate as well as cities and communities to get to a net zero environment. It's going to cost a lot of money and there's going to be trillions of dollars that need to be invested, and we wanted to participate in that. So that's our third strategy. And then our fourth is a securities business. So everything I've talked about is direct investment and control. We bought into a business called Presima about a year and a half ago, and it's an institutional business that invests in global REITs. So there's a lot of times when we talk to our investors who say, listen, I don't know whether I should invest on the private side, but because it's going to take a long time to build a portfolio best in class and manage it. And there's others that can do that. And so that business is, you know, was about $1 billion when we bought it. It's $1.5 billion now, where we can go into different markets and invest in good real estate that's well managed with a good team, and it creates liquidity for our investors. So that's really the four parts of our business. And we're about $13 billion of assets under management. We invest in Canada, the US, and in Europe. We have about 200 people at our platform. So, and Canada will always be a place that is home to us, and we will continue to invest. But there's other opportunities. And as I said earlier, like, it gives you better perspective when you're able to actually see what's happening outside of Canada when you come back here.
Yeah. Take the good ideas home.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Or take the good ideas abroad, depending on where the good ideas come from.
And be humble like a Canadian, because they like that. Yeah.
With a little confidence, though, it's okay.
Yeah.
There's a bunch there. And I want to go back to the credit component. Could you maybe just expand on that? That was a business in the U.S. You said it was credit underwriting, but for what means? I don't follow.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'd look to get into the credit business, and up until the pandemic, up until, you know, 2020, it was a crowded space. And in terms of where you could lend money and on a risk adjusted basis, it really wasn't that attractive to us. But then the pandemic changed everything, right? And so there was a company called Annaly, which is really a mortgage agency business, $100 billion business. And they got into actually wholesaling loans on their balance sheet.
Was it single family loans, commercial loans?
Commercial loans. Okay. And yeah, mostly all commercial. They did some equity, owned some grocery stores. And I think what happened was the CEO was like, listen, we're a $100 billion company. We have $3 billion of commercial mortgages. And every quarter, because of what was happening with COVID and lockdowns, and then there was a US election and a lot of uncertainty, we're like, I'm just gonna sell this business. And there was an opportunity for us to come in and buy a good loan book that was performing at a discount. But not only that, came with a team. Because to go and get into, as you know, like into the lending business, it's hard to build it from scratch. If you can start with a book that's performing with originators, with a team, and you've got scale, you can grow that. And so it was just an entry point for us. It was timing.
Great.
How do you feel about US debt right now?
I mean, for us, the business is, we don't have a lot of legacy issues. And we bought in at the right time in the middle of COVID. So I would say the two things that are driving our business now would be credit, transitional credit, because there is a lack of debt availability today, and our ability to actually get, I would say, better returns and a lower you know, stack of the capital structure today. I mean, it looks, you know, for us to put out equity versus put out credit today, it's more attractive. So I would say the credit business is performing quite well. And a lot of our institutional investors ask us a lot about like, what's going on with your credit business? So that and special situations, I would say those are the two things that our investors are looking for.
What's the best ideas you have brought home?
Well, I mean, first of all, we try to be consistent with everything. It's not like what we do in Canada and what we do in Europe. I think we try to be consistent with everything we do and our philosophy. And I'm sure Blair has gone through this with you. It's like, what's our basis? What are the economic drivers? Where are rents? Cap rates, that's one metric, but it's really like, where do you think you can rent space and what's your basis? And are rents going to grow, especially in today in a rising interest rate environment? If your rents can't grow, you can get offside very quickly. So yeah, I think that's one thing that you have to, like, not all asset classes are performing the same today. So you have to take a look at that. So it's not, you know, what we do in Europe is different than what we do in Canada. I think you need to have that same perspective, is basis and rents. And then the second thing is, where's capital not flowing? Because sometimes, you know, if capital's not flowing and there's a lack of liquidity, it doesn't mean that the asset's broken. And it doesn't mean that the real estate is bad, but you can actually buy real estate at an attractive price.
But you guys had that strategy, and this is, I'm pulling from the interview with Blair a couple of years ago, where, you know, Calgary office, you know, had some legacy challenges and you were going along Calgary office just for that very reason. And you guys have a history. Again, I won't reiterate all the conversation with Blair, but a lot of that conversation was around, you know, you guys looking for where is the capital going, not necessarily where is it right now. And so the Calgary office market was one of those sort of move first and that they will follow. And so maybe let's just dive into some of the office fundamentals going on right now. You mentioned all asset classes are not equal. That's probably one of the most struggling.
For sure.
You guys have, you know, a portfolio of office. What are you looking at it? What's the perspective? How are you thinking about office right now?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's not just about office. I mean, we got into the grocery business really in the GFC, which is the same thing, bringing Canadian investors to the US, because basically regional banks and CMBS had shut off and we were able to go buy at a discount where we thought they were good performing assets. You know, office is a struggle today, but I think it's unique. I mean, I've been in the business for over 30 years. So it's not just about rising interest rates. It's a fundamental change of behavior of people. And not every market behaves the same. So if we were in Tokyo, everyone goes to the office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Korea, Seoul, all of Asia is like that for the most part, right? It's back to normal.
And then even if you look at Europe and the big cities, I think there is a correlation to how people live. So if you live in small accommodations, so if you're a family of four and live in 1,000 square feet, it's pretty hard for you to work from home. And if there's good public transit and it's easy for you to get to the office, you're going to go to the office. But in Canada, because we're fortunate to live at such a good quality of life and have a nice big house, and we can have like maybe a secondary house. And then unfortunately, we don't have great public transit. So you have to drive to get in. I can see why people are like, why do I want to come downtown Toronto? It's going to take me an hour. And I don't have any options, and I live in a big place and space. And so there's human behavior dynamics that are going on. So Canada's different than, say, investing in Munich or investing in West End London office. So you need to actually have perspective on where you are. But office is a challenge today, and I think it's because of behavior. I really believe that it's hard to develop and build a business if people are at home on their couch. I think we're social animals, and office will not be obsolete. It's not going to be the dodo bird. I think it will always be part, but how we behave and how we use the office has changed. And I think longer term, people will come back to the office 5 days a week.
I have yet to hear someone say, you know, we've made this back to return or return to office strategy and we're done. We're not changing it ever again. Like, I think there's a continuing evolution of what this looks like, and the leaders and the employers kind of figuring it out. And of course, that impacts the tenants and the landlords. I wanted to go, you know, pivot a little bit. You mentioned retail, and I'll raise this, then we can keep talking about how it impacts your future strategy. I told Blair it was him, but it was actually you I saw on a panel years ago. Sorry, Blair.
Was it complimentary?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I was a year or two in. Someone had given me the pass to go to the Toronto Real Estate Forum. So I was coming to pretend to be somebody else. I picked a random room. And
I do that with Blair all the time.
Yeah, and you were on the panel. And you were talking about investing in grocery-anchored retail, because that grocery building isn't just grocery store. It's an industrial building. This is before fulfillment centers were a thing. This is all long before e-commerce. You were just talking about how what this could be used for is plenty. It happens to be a grocery store today, but it could be whatever, right, in the future. And so that's a good investment thesis. For me at the time, and I said this to Blair, but it was actually you that gave me the aha moment of real estate is, you know, much more dynamic than what it is currently. There's lots of different ways to look at things and the perception. We're in a very interesting environment right now, obviously, with many different changing fundamentals. We've kind of been dubbing it the Great Reset that's occurring. How is your brain moving? Because you worked in distressed assets starting, like you've seen these cycles. What kind of things are you thinking about? Where is the next opportunity to kind of take advantage?
You want another aha moment?
Is it? Well, yeah. Okay, blow my mind,
yeah,
Brady.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that I have the aha moment, but we're definitely going through change right now. And change is difficult and sometimes can be painful. And in my opinion, you know, the last 15 years, not so much, I would say, North America, but in other markets, like zero interest rates were never real. But people got comfortable with negative interest rates and zero interest rates. So if you were actually betting on that forever and buying assets at 3 caps with the inability to have rental growth, you can get offside very quickly. And unfortunately, there's going to be pain as values change. But that also creates opportunities for platforms like us. So I think having a little bit of perspective and having a little bit of experience, we're actually pretty excited about what we can do over the next, I would say, 12, 24, 36 months. Things will slow down, and they already are, right? There'll be less activity because people don't want to sell in a market like this when there's lack of liquidity. And there will be a sense where people will start to move because people will be forced to sell assets. And that's going to create a huge opportunity. So to get back to like the grocery and that contrarian, like we always said, it's about logistics, it's about food. And it's pretty hard to displace food. And then what happened, we were in 2015 when Whole Foods was sold to Amazon, everyone's like, it's over. No one's going to go to a grocery store again. And we're like, no, if you really watch what Amazon was doing is they needed distribution, right? And they'll do it from their big fulfillment centers, but they actually 90% is picked from the local store. So it's just having a little bit of different
last mile, right?
Right. Because everyone can go, oh my God, like this is like, it's because of social media, it's over, it's done. Back when we started to go to the US in 2009, people were like, the US is done, it's over. And we were like, what, you're going to bet against the US economy? So it's sometimes you have to have a little perspective and not jump in with the whole theme. It's just the same thing with office. If you can get through this next little period, like I don't think office is dead. But people today, it's over. It's very binary. And I think you need to have the wherewithal. And I know that Blair and I talk about this all the time. It's like, listen, you can have the best asset and put the bad capital structure in, too much debt, and you can lose the business. You can have an asset that's actually not that sexy and have no debt and make a lot of money. So it's really, you need to like understand the broader picture of what's going on and then be able to have the wherewithal to get through. And get down always to the fundamentals of what's driving the revenue, what's driving the asset. Why does someone want to occupy that? But whether it's like a residential place, whether it's an industrial building, whether it's an office building, whatever, it's like, why do people want to be there? Why do you want to own that land? And it's as fundamental as that, to put debt aside. That's financial engineering.
We can't put debt aside. We're lenders. It's the forefront of everything we think about. Are you into the alternative asset classes in real estate?
I would say we invest across all of the asset classes. And then even in our lending business, we would do self-storage, we do multifamily, we do hotels. And then on the equity side, we're more conventional. But yeah, I would say we would look at any type of asset, right? We own a data center. Yeah, so.
You can tell you're a commercial purist because you talked about multifamily being an alternative asset class, whereas we view it as
the core.
Yeah.
Only a couple of minutes left, Brady, so yeah. I wanted to bring it all back around. You talked about in the 90s it being sort of an illiquidity crisis that you had this fortune of experiencing in your formative years. I'm not going to call it a crisis, but this incident we're experiencing right now, there seems to be a ton of quote-unquote dry powder. Like this is not a lack of liquidity in the marketplace, but yet valuations seem to be just moving, trending upwards all across the board. There's a tipping point. How are you guys perceiving that? Are you thinking about it? What's the thought process? What's the time frame? Like it's one of those, it's a very curious part of the change in cycles we're in right now. Because we know values are increasing. There's a price discovery world. How great is it?
Values are decreasing.
When I say cap, yeah, you know what I mean. Like, everyone understands what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Once they start increasing, then we buy.
Yeah, there you go. But not the first time.
Listen, when you start to invest, people will think they're crazy. What are they doing? I think right now in my opinion, like talking to equity in certain asset classes is probably not the people you should be talking to. You should probably be talking to the debt side when you're doing this correction of values. And so, and I think that's why you don't see a lot of transactions right now. You will never know what the bottom of the market is, right? It's going to be a gut feel, and it's going to get back to like, am I comfortable owning this asset at that price, right? And can I own it forever at that price? And we're not there yet, because I think a lot of people is like, well, even why would I go buy that debt at 80 cents when I think I could buy it at 30 cents 12 months from now? So there's a lot of that going on, and you'll never know when that bottom is. It's something that is an art. It's not a science. Like it's fun with numbers. You can all throw numbers in and it can be this, it can be that. It's going to be a gut feel when the market starts to actually rebound. And so I think having dry powder, there's a lot of dry powder on the sideline, but unfortunately you need a lot of debt too. Real estate, I mean, there's more debt in the market than there is equity. And right now it's harder to do large transactions. You can do one-off transaction. There's still liquidity, but to do a larger M&A deal would be difficult today. So I think we're looking at, I would say, those type of larger opportunities. It's just not,
there's not time. Yeah. Right, just today's not the day. Yeah.
Exactly.
And how close to the trough do you want to get? Like the minute you think we're coming off the trough, get in there, wait for further signals, like be the guy that this year, you know, at the conference next year, they're toasting you for like, boy, you just called the.
Yeah. I think it's, as I said, it's impossible to call the bottom, but it gets down to like, where do you think rents are going? Where do you think the economic engines are, right? If you feel that they're not there and there's weakness, I don't think it's a good time to invest. But if you think that it is starting to turn, and you think if you can have conviction that actually rents are stable and they're going to grow, like forget about cap rates, forget about values, but the actual like demand for someone wants to be in that space and you can lease it and you can get comfortable with that is, that's the time to buy. But if things are weakening and you're like, I don't think I can lease that building, I don't even know what I can lease it at, probably not the right time to buy.
Yeah. Or sell.
Or sell. Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, maybe sometimes you have to sell because you have no choice. And that's when
we haven't seen that yet, which I think is why you think it's too early. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Then you can put your skill set from the distressed asset fund from the start of your career back into play.
Yeah. Well, but it's the same. But you know what? It's the same thing. Whether you own an asset like that's performing or whether you own an asset that's broken. I think like, you know, this is a real REIT. That's just a structure. You actually have to perform the same way, whether you're a private company that owns real estate or you're a REIT. It's the same thing. And it's the same fundamentals. It gets back
to probably just more regulations, more reporting.
Yeah, there's more reporting. You need to behave the same way. It's pretty basic. You got to lease a building. You got to keep it occupied and try to grow income. It's the same way everywhere.
When did you create the REIT? Sorry, I missed that. Because you said they spun out of sort of the opportunity fund.
Well, the Slate Grocery REIT was 2012. We listed that. We started buying really in 2010, 2011 on the private side. And then we were growing. We liked the business and it was an opportunity for us to raise more equity. So we listed it. And then Slate Office REIT was actually, we privatized a company that was called Huntington that had a bunch of different assets and actually had an investment in a small cap REIT. And we just transformed it and grew that into Slate Office REIT.
So here we are today.
And here we are.
A real REIT.
And yeah.
I think we're out of time, Brady. Thanks very much for taking the giving us the opportunity to ask you some questions. I'd like to thank First National for powering the podcast. Thanks to Granite REIT for sponsoring this video series here at the Real REIT, part of the Real Estate Forums. Again, thanks Brady for coming on.
Yeah, thanks guys.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast, after show where Aaron and I discuss the interview that just took place. Brady was a good counterpoint to his brother, who we've had on. I mean, it's a very interesting Canadian success story. And we did have the privilege of interviewing his brother probably 2 years ago. It was definitely in the middle of COVID because it was done over video. And it was really nice to get Brady on, kind of get the other part of the story. My big takeaway, and he raised it, is, you know, that they're just not just two REITs. Okay. I will admit that to a certain degree, I thought that was the case because they're visible. They're REITs, you know, there's only, you know, so many in Canada. They get lots of attention. And so I was one of those people that probably thought something along those lines. I was not, you know, aware of the credit purchasing down in the States, not aware of, you know, the ventures into Germany, ventures into
infrastructure.
The US. Infrastructure. Yeah, exactly. It's, I guess you'd call that an area of real estate that we have nothing to do with for most of the industry people that we talk to. I knew they were big. I had no idea it was like that.
Yeah, it seems to be a lot of ventures, as you put them, that they're kind of expanding into. We always had so much respect for those brothers. Like I said, like one of the first panels I ever watched as a young, you know, real estate pup was these, you know, them talking about how Brady talked about how it's just, it's, you can look at real estate differently. And I think they've always kind of maintained that, right, throughout their career. So it's very interesting to hear just how they continue to expand.
They were talking about last mile 8 or 9 years before everybody else is talking about last mile, right? I mean, like, I don't know, I try and remember now, even though we just did the interview, that how much we got into it, but it was their thesis. This is a long time ago. You know, this is common thesis now, but the thesis then was buy all the grocery you can because it's not going anywhere. As we did mention, you know, food is very geography dependent, but more importantly, you're buying sizable tracts of land in key urban locations because food thinks about last minute access, you know, for decades ahead of everybody else thinking about it from an industrial use. And so it's an interesting concept to roll out 8 or 9 years ago, even though now it seems, you know, obvious because everybody is a genius looking backwards.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, and it, you know, I'll tell you, if you didn't pick it up over the interview, just a gentleman too, right? Like we do a lot of these and, you know, he was happy to chat and came early and, you know, wanted to get to know us and stayed later and wanted to chat. Like it's just a really down earth individual. So it, that was a pleasure of an interview. Thanks for listening, everybody. Till next time. Talk to you then.
Thank you for listening to the CRE podcast. The information from this broadcast is not to be relied upon as financial, investing, professional accounting, or legal advice. First National Financial LP holds Financial Services Commission of Ontario license number 10514 and 11252.